Chapter 20. Kroger's column of rumbling vehicles, marching infantry and mobile artillery, with their barrels raised to the heavens, reached the heart of the citadel first. Moving unopposed, there was little need for caution, for Kroger felt emptiness like a physical absence in his gut. Only by an exercise of his will was he able to quell the urge to charge at speed for their objective. The advance through the citadel had grated at his nerves. The rasping, unfocused hostility he felt from every lambent green wall was like a weapon aimed at his head. His body was flooded with combat stims, and he flexed his fingers on the grip of his chainsword. He wanted to kill something, anything, just to feel the release of the tension that had been building in him ever since they had landed on this world. The column spread out as it emerged from the wide plaza street, moving smoothly into a staggered line. Despite his avowed distrust of Harker, the warriors of his former Grand Battalion were well-trained and highly disciplined. And if there was one place capable of sealing in the remains of a doomed god, the building at the heart of Amon Nishak Kalis was it. The sepulchre of Isha's doom was a monumental palace, sprawling and richly ornamented with bulbous mourn towers and sweeping ivory-roofed domes. Its facades were awash with curling arches and lofty processionals that were at once airy and crafted as if spun from moonbeams, and yet possessed of a strength that belied their gossamer fragility. The entire structure was like a great sculpture of ice and glass, like a natural accretion of organic crystal that had grown in some dark cave and which, once exposed to the light, had furiously accelerated its growth in new and unexpected ways. It was a wholly natural-looking formation, but the subtlety of its precise ratios was impossible to miss, organic and artificial at the same time. The enormous structure was all contradiction, fortified and open, geometric and yet seemingly unfettered by the constraints of an architect. Thousands of the same crystalline statues that lined every roadway stood immobile in glittering alcoves and atop ranked plinths along the curving walkways that led up to a tall opening in its frontage, a narrow portal flanked by two enormous replicas of the smaller sentinels. They were easily the equal in size, if not stature, of the Mortis engines. Kroger had seen similar war machines wreak havoc on the battlefield. But these representations were unmoving and glassy, fragile and easily broken. The undersea light that permeated the entire citadel was strongest here. The walls of the sepulchre of Isha's doom, radiant with their own inner illumination. The smooth stone of the ground was veined with that same glow, capillaries of energy and a network of living light. Kroger's footfalls left lightless bruises on the ground, and he felt as though he were walking on the surface of some planet-wide neural network. A rhino forested with vox aerials ground to a halt next to him, black worms of unlight spreading from the pressing weight of its bulk. Kroger felt Harker's presence before his lieutenant spoke.
"Something you should hear," said Harker, a vox headset pressed to his ear.
"What is it?" snapped Kroger, angry but unable to say why. Harker held out the headset and said, "Listen." Kroger removed his helmet and climbed onto the running board of the vehicle. He snatched the headset and mashed it to the side of his head. He heard nothing beyond a mournful howl of static, rising and falling like a desert wind at night.
"What am I supposed to be hearing?" he asked.
"Keep listening," urged Harker. Kroger kept the headset pressed to the side of his face as the lead element of Perturabo's column emerged from the wide streets a kilometre and a half to the east. Streaming honour banners were just visible over the roofs of the intervening structures, and the honking bellows of the two titans echoed dully through the open plaza. Kroger's gaze strayed farther east, but there was no sign of Falk's column yet.
"I'm not hearing anything apart from static," he said.
"Listen harder."
Kroger glared at Harker, wondering how much trouble it would cause were he to kill the former warsmith right now. He dismissed the idea as he heard snatches of what sounded like Imperial Gothic mired in the static. Nothing certain and nothing he could fully understand, but there was something there.
"What is it?"
"Encrypted Vox traffic," said Harker. 10th Legion comms. Harker watched as Kroger's commandeered rhino raced off to rejoin Perturabo's blade of the trident thrust at the Citadel's vitals. He found it impossible to keep the sneer from his lips at the thought that he had been displaced from command by a common thug like Kroger. The man had no nobility to him and possessed little in the way of culture. Harker had done his research and knew that Kroger had no blood worth a damn in his lineage. He was peasant-born, a ragamuffin child, with a fortuitous confluence of genes and a barely acceptable level of genetic variance that only just kept him from being rejected by the Legion's fleshsmiths. To have such a low-born fool in command of a grand battalion was an insult to the honour of the Legion. The thought made him shiver in disgust, and he keyed the Vox to the previously agreed-upon frequency, one at the very edge of usability.
"You were right," he said,
not identifying himself and knowing that only one person would be listening on the other end. "His anger is growing beyond his control." A swoop and sway of static followed, with clicks and burps of encryption.
"You told him of the 10th Legion Vox traffic?" said a voice, heavy with distortion.
"I did," said Harker, "and it was all he could do not to charge the sepulchre all by himself with his sword waving."
"He is low-born," said the voice. "You can expect little else from those not of noble lineage."
"It galls me that Perturabo cannot see it.
The Lord of Iron is wise in many things, but he was wrong to remove you from leadership," said the voice. "Having mongrels like Kroger in command is the thin end of the wedge. It is indicative of a slide into mediocrity that would lead to polluted bloodlines being raised to the fighting ranks."
"Over my dead body," spat Harker.
"We are the noble blood of Olympia," said the voice. "We have that uniting factor, and blood will prove true in the end."
"But we can hasten that end, yes?"
"Indeed we can," said the voice, "and not just for Kroger. Forex can trace his blood to one of the 12, but he will never support your reinstatement."
"Then he has to die too," said Harker.
"I am master of the Storbis Ashk," said Toromino. "I can make that happen."
Perturabo didn't need the flickering data streams cascading down the side of his visor display to know that they had reached their destination. The sepulchre of Isha's doom was an edifice like no other he had seen or imagined. The proportions were effortlessly harmonious, its structural elements innately perfect in a way that no amount of training or study could replicate. There could be no other temple raised that would do justice to the final resting place of a god. Except there likely was no god, he reminded himself.
"Takes your breath away, doesn't it?" said Fulgrim, approaching with his phoenix guard and the cringing form of Karuchi Vora. "Beyond anything you or I might design and commit to the earth?"
Perturabo bristled at the thinly veiled insult and only bit back a bitter response because he knew Fulgrim was correct. Just looking at the spun sugar of its web-like flying buttresses and coiling walkways, he knew he could never have designed anything like it. Yet that did not lessen the sting of Fulgrim's words or the apparent pleasure his brother took in voicing them.
"No, perhaps not," he agreed. "But it's what's within that interests me more."
"Absolutely," agreed Fulgrim, staring with undisguised hunger at the wondrous tomb palace. "It gladdens my soul to finally see the object of our quest."
Perturabo looked past his brother to Karuchi Vora. The Eldar guide seemed even more apprehensive now that they had finally reached their goal, as though just being here was making him ill. He had the sickly pallor of withdrawal and body-wide shivers.
"Your guide doesn't appear to think so," he said. "Why is that, Vora?"
The Eldar swallowed heavily and looked up at Perturabo through eyes the colour of blood-stained milk.
"Would you be happy to visit a mass grave? Does being in the presence of the dead make you smile?"
Vora's tone was insubordinate, verging on hostile, and Perturabo thought of killing the Eldar right now.
"This is no grave," he said. "This is a city built to the memory of the dead, nothing more."
"Be kind to the creature," said Fulgrim,
though even he was openly sceptical of the Eldar's explanation.
"We are here, and that is in no small measure down to my allowing him to live."
"So, we're here. Now what?" asked Perturabo.
"Isn't it obvious?" said Fulgrim. "We go in."
To a warrior raised on a volcanic world of molten rivers and sulphurous skies, cold was normally something Atesh Tasa felt keenly. But he no longer felt the chill of the apothecarian. Though he had stripped down to his thin body glove to avoid any possible secondary heating of Ulrak Branthan's casket from the power plant of his warplate, the discomfort of the low temperatures was more than offset by the stasis-sealed mystery before him. Freighter Thematica had run diagnostic checks on all the machines keeping Branthan alive and had found no flaws, no unexpected quirks in their construction, and nothing that could adequately explain how a bolter wound had miraculously vanished from a warrior kept entirely in a time out of time. Miraculous. A word so casually deployed, but one that silences inquisition. Calling something a miracle denied inquiry by attributing an ineffability to its occurrence. The credo of the apothecarian was that there were no such things as miracles, only events. Only when the explanation of an event was more incredible than the event itself could such a thing be counted as miraculous. Right now, Tasa was inclined to believe in miracles. He had examined the wound as best he could through the inviolable bubble surrounding Branthan, and there could be no doubt that the wound had almost entirely vanished. Not completely, for there was a pinkish cast to the skin, indicative of scarring and healing. Even outside a stasis field, such a wound would have taken longer to heal. With the warriors of the 10th Legion below on the planet the Eldar Guide had brought them to, the Sisyphium felt very empty, its corridors prowled by servitors who cared nothing for the comfort of lonely souls left aboard ship while there was fighting to be done. Tasa was a warrior too, one of some note amongst his fellow Nocturnians, but the care of Ulrak Branthan could be left to no one else but an apothecary. Besides, the mission to the planet's surface had the whiff of revenge to it, and such missions rarely ended well. Freighter Thematica remained in the bowels of the ship, undoing the damage his ill-advised experiment had caused. Tasa remembered the furious argument between the freighter and Cadmus Tyro like two thunderheads colliding. But Tyro was a captain and the designated proxy of Ulrak Branthan. Thematica was going nowhere. Tasa paced the apothecarian, tapping his fingertips over the surface of his data slate, reviewing the latest batch of monitoring readings. Ulrak Branthan's biometrics were slowed to a standstill by the temperature, let alone the stasis field, and the results were the same as the last 100 times he had checked them. Nothing could change within a stasis field, something that should be self-evident, but somehow in that unchanging environment, something had changed. Branthan's body had managed to heal itself, or rather, something had caused it to heal without registering on any of the highly advanced, incredibly accurate monitoring devices. Could it be the Heart of Iron? In all his probes of Branthan's flesh, this alone was an element of uncertainty. Not even the Iron Hands could explain its workings. All that was known of the artifact was that Ferus Manus was said to have been given it by a ghost in the Land of Shadows centuries ago. As contrary to the imperial truth, and as unlikely as that sounded, it was the only explanation Tasa had been given as to its provenance.
Every senior Iron Hand claimed to have some relic of vanished technology from that desolate, benighted wasteland. The place must have been a veritable treasure trove of plunder, with ghosts lining up to hand over their priceless trinkets. Dismissing such thoughts, Tasso retuned his attention to the grievously wounded warrior. Unmoving, icy mist fogged the casket, but Tasso's red orbs could easily pierce the translucent sheen to the warrior below. Branthan's body, regardless of any healed bolter wound, was still a mess of bloody skin and ruptured flesh, broken bones and shredded musculature. The heart of iron remained locked to his chest, a silent, unmoving parasite whose function defied easy explanation. From what little Tasso could ascertain, he believed the device was attempting to regrow the inner structure of the captain's body, yet it was doing so by feeding on, for want of a better term, his life force. On a warrior whose wounds were not mortal, it would probably heal the damage without killing him, but Branthan's injuries were so severe that any healing done would be at the expense of his life. This miracle would likely kill him. Tasso circled the casket, all the while knowing that there was nothing more he could do for the man inside without detailed real-time data. There was only one way to gather such data, and Cadmus Tyro would never allow him to bring Branthan out of stasis without a cadre of Iron Hands around in case those moments turned out to be his last. But Cadmus Tyro wasn't here. The warriors of Nocturne were not known for their rebellious streak. In fact, the chains of duty in which they wrapped themselves bound them to causes and courses of action that might be deemed unwise, but which were followed through to the end. Yet Tasso felt his hand inching towards the machinery regulating the casket's temperature and the gene-locked stasis controls. "To help you, I need to bring you close to death," he said. The further damage that might be done by rousing Branthan from his cryonic state, conflicting with his oath to do no harm. He resolved that dilemma by rationalizing that if he were able to save the captain, then that damage would be an acceptable price to pay. The thought of Tyro and Cybus's retribution, should something go wrong, momentarily stayed his hand. Even were he to learn something vital, they would still be furious, so there was really no sense in hesitating. Tasso was heartsick at keeping a man in a state of vegetative existence, a man who was dead in all but the most generous terms. Wasn't it, in fact, doing more harm keeping Branthan like this? His moral quandary resolved, Tasso quickly set up his bio-recording equipment, plugging his narthesium into the casket to monitor every aspect of Ulrich Branthan's physiology. If he was going to do this, he'd have to do it right, leaving nothing to chance and seizing every opportunity to gather as much information as he could. With everything set up, Tasso unlocked the controls. He took a breath of cold air, now feeling the chill of the sterile apothecarian settling in his bones. Or was it the chill of uncertainty? He had already made his mind up, so he didn't know why he was hesitating. Was he giving himself one last chance to turn back, realizing that he might be about to kill Branthan? Tasso turned the brass dial of the power coupling to zero, and the stasis field fell away like a dropped theatre curtain. The curling mists in the casket churned as time recommenced within, and the frozen captain once again rejoined the natural flow of the universe. Having crossed this Rubicon, Tasso now began to increase the temperature of the captain's body in fractional increments. The lights on his narthesium blinked and clicked as swarms of data mobbed its memory coils. The biomonitoring equipment chattered as fresh information flowed from the thawing body, spewing ticker tapes of punched data ribbons. The devices showed increased neural activity in the prefrontal lobes and a general increase in synapse communications. Soon, the captain's brain would reach a level where cognition and awareness would be restored. When that happened, Tasso would need to be succinct in his questions.
Brain activity continued to rise, and he watched the heart of iron as it extruded yet more hair-fine filaments into Branthon's body. The segmented limbs slithered around his body as though probing for something, and it vented a thin stream of toxic fumes that smelled of rotting flesh.
"Urz,"
said Branthon, finishing a sentence that had begun weeks ago.
"Captain, I am Apothecary Tassa. Your wounds are healing, but I am gathering information to ascertain why."
A pause, while the captain's barely thawed brain raced to catch up to the present.
"The mission
is ongoing," said Tassa, watching the spiking volume of data flow from the casket. "We are at the target world, and your warriors are attempting to foil the traitor's plans." Branthon's brain activity suddenly spiked with waveforms Tassa had never seen, and which caused the captain's body to twitch and spasm. Tassa rose to his feet, looking into the casket, as Ulrak Branthon's eyes flickered with an eldritch green light.
"Aedris."
"Captain?"
"This world, the dead call it Aedris."
"I don't understand, Captain," said Tassa. Had the captain been having lucid dreams while he was locked in stasis? That should be impossible, but if this mission into the heart of a warp storm had taught Tassa anything, it was that words like impossible were for the foolish and the unwary. The green shimmer to Branthon's eyes was surely a sign of something very wrong, but he hesitated to drop the temperature and re-engage the stasis field. Instead, he asked, "What dead?"
"The souls of Aedris. I hear them all. They're crying out in terror."
The captain's voice trailed off, and Tassa realized Branthon's synapse network had decayed to the point where he was experiencing auditory hallucinations. It would be a mercy to let him die now before the honorable hero he had been was reduced to a rambling madman.
"You have to stop the Angel Exterminatus,"
said Branthon, as Tarsa's hand hovered over the temperature controls.
"What did you say?" asked Tassa.
The data squirt inloaded by Sabic Wayland had included mention of the mythical creature, but Branthon's words felt more specific, more immediately relevant.
"He seeks to be reborn on Aedris. You have to stop it."
Tassa struggled to connect the captain's words with what Wayland and Sharokin had heard on Hydrocordatus. The Angel Exterminatus was a dead god of the Eldar, imprisoned beneath the world by their race's supreme deity. What that actually meant in real terms wasn't clear, but something of Branthon's utterances didn't gel.
"What is the Angel Exterminatus?" asked Tassa, instinctively knowing this was the most important question he would ever ask. "All the very worst things in the world, given flesh and form."
"How do you know this?"
"This world, it's alive. It cries for help. It waits."
"It waits?" asked Tassa. "What is it waiting for?"
"For its makers to carry the dead home."
A cordon was established around the sepulchre, and it was immediately apparent that it would need no lengthy siege to breach its walls. It boasted no defences and no in-place guns. Its approaches were unmarked by deep ditches, fire pits, minefields, or tearing wires, and the portal between the towering crystalline giants was unbarred by any gate. Perturabo instructed Forex to begin working on establishing a fortified position in the open plaza before the sepulchre, and his lead triarch set about the task with gusto, requisitioning every available rhino for the task. To surround the sepulchre would require thousands more Castellan rhinos. Thus, Forex crafted a rectangular, secure area with angled bastion corners, the simplest fortress to craft, with no blind spots. As each rhino was driven into place and the armour plates unfolded, the central area of the plaza changed from being a place of shimmering light and ghostly laments on the wind to a place of cold iron, black spikes, coiled razor wire, and armoured emplacements. Few, even among the Fourth Legion, knew fortifications like Forex, and even as Perturabo looked over, the final towers were rising at the corners of the emplaced position. The mortise engines lifted the last elements into place as a final pair of rhinos backed into position to form the two leaves of a motorized gate. "Your warrior works fast," noted Fulgrim, and Perturabo saw the jittering urge to be moving in every twitch of his limbs and every tick on his alabaster features. "But we should not linger."
"The weapons aren't going anywhere," said Perturabo. "We don't move until I have confirmation our fortified positions are secure."
Fulgrim nodded, but there was a curt impatience to it. Perturabo already knew all three fortified positions were in readiness. Despite the resistance of the rock, the fortress surrounding the landing zone was now secure, as was the makeshift fortress of rhinos around the citadel's walls. This latest fortification was as good as complete, but Perturabo took the time to study Fulgrim and his assembled host. His brother was sheened in sweat, but it was not perspiration that beaded his brow. Fulgrim was sweating light. Faintly, to be sure, but visible to Jen Hunt's sight that saw beyond what even legionary eyes saw. Beads of light gathered at Fulgrim's fingertips and fell to the ground, where they were swallowed by the earth and dissipated. He wondered if Fulgrim was aware of the radiance bleeding from him, and decided he must be. His brother's armour strained against his body, and his features were drawn and tired, as though only by an effort of will was he still standing. His captains looked no better, like hounds straining at the leash. Caceron stuck close to Fulgrim's side, while Verosian and his shrieking warriors roared and seethed with their bizarre sonic cannons. Eidolon and a cadre of bulky warriors in cataphracti terminator armour stood ready to spearhead the Emperor's children's advance. The Lord Commander's flesh was suffused with a similar light to that enveloping Fulgrim, a deathly radiance that had no place within a living being. Alone of the Phoenicians' warriors, the swordsman Lucius seemed unaffected by the sense of potentiality that coursed through the Emperor's children. He glanced over towards Perturabo as though aware of the scrutiny and gave him an expansive bow. Perturabo saw through the blatant insincerity and felt a killing urge that saw him lift Forgebreaker from its harness at his back. Carucci Vora stood next to Fulgrim, his hands knotting and twisting like a guilty man who knew that they would never be clean of blood. Perturabo knew he should kill the Elder now, just crush his frail body with one blow of his hammer, but he sensed there was yet something he could learn from their guide. Kroger and Falk appeared, each warrior giving him a nod of readiness. Only two blades of his trident would follow him, but that would have to be enough. The Iron Circle lifted their shields as Perturabo sent a pulse of activation through his MIU to the organic wetware of their cybernetic control centres. "Does that mean we can go now?" asked Fulgrim, needy and irritating.
"It does," said Perturabo.
The warriors chosen to accompany the two Primarchs within the crystal beauty of the dome's sepulchre marched in their wake. The iron warriors as regimented as the day they had first formed up on the martial fields of Olympus. The Emperor's children, like a host of raucous barbarians, hundreds of banners flew overhead and the howling skirl of sonic weapons battered the air and tortured the ears with their echoes. Thousands of Fulgrim's followers came too, each bearing rigid containers across their shoulders. Perturabo had watched them unload the cargo 20s and fill those containers with what looked like crystal shards. Burdened by such heavy weight, they would not keep up with the legionaries, and Perturabo wasn't about to wait for them. With the iron circle forming a heavy wedge of shields before them, Perturabo and Fulgrim led the way up a curling walkway that approached the main portal. Only as they drew near did its scale truly become apparent. 300 meters high and 20 wide, it was a vertical slash in the translucent crystal walls of the citadel. The sea-green glow that spread to the rest of the fortress was, it seemed, a radiance that only went one way. Inside, all was darkness, an enfolding blackness that swallowed the light and allowed none to escape. Perturabo was reminded of the great singularity of the heart of the Eye of Terror, and did not care for that likeness one bit. Was the interior of the Sepulchre of Isha's Doom a region that could be spatially mapped, or did its internal geography owe nothing to empirical measurements? "I can feel it," said Fulgrim, as they marched between the clawed feet of the flanking guardians of the sepulchre. Light flickered through them like glittering shoals of fish darting away from a hunter's lure. Nothing here had yet reacted to their presence, but how long that would last once they were inside was something Perturabo wasn't keen to find out. Perturabo halted their advance and turned to his brother.
"Before we go any further, there is something I have to ask you, brother," said Perturabo.
Fulgrim's eyes narrowed, tense and wary.
"What?"
"Is there anything I should know?" Perturabo asked. "I give you this one last chance to tell me anything you have kept to yourself."
Perturabo saw the lie before it was spoken.
"No, brother," said the Phoenician. "All is as I have told you."
Perturabo nodded, the answer exactly what he'd expected. He turned away from Fulgrim and, with his warriors at his side and his robotic guardians around him, marched into the sepulchre. Darkness welcomed him, folding around his senses in a way that confirmed it was wholly unnatural. His senses spread out, questing at the edges of his perceptions in ways unknown to mortals. What would be unremitting blackness, impenetrable and cloying and impossible to escape, was, to him, merely a gloaming. The portal led them within an echoing vestibule of sorts, its colossal dimensions seeming to alter with every glance. A number of passageways led onwards, leaf-shaped arches of deeper darkness. But Perturabo found it next to impossible to fix on exactly how many there were.
"Parlour tricks," sneered Fulgrim, looking around the twisting passageways leading off in many different directions at once.
"No," said Perturabo, "it's much more than that."
"Eldar witchery," spat Fulgrim, "nothing of note."
The beads of light falling from Fulgrim's eyes were radiant tears, and the droplets sweating from his hands bloomed into liquid sunspots as they struck the marble-smooth floor of the sepulchre. Even the mortal warriors could see the Phoenician's light within these walls. The Emperor's children cried out in adoration. The Iron Warriors ignored it. Perturabo kept his gaze fixed on the black walls before him, seeing something in the shifting pathways and capricious dimensions of this space that was familiar to him. He had seen workings like this before.
"It's a labyrinth," he said. "And I know labyrinths."
From a position of concealment high on a domed tomb farther out in the precincts opposite the citadel, Nykona Sharukin and Sabek Wayland watched the two primarchs lead their warriors within. Perhaps 1,000 legionaries and as many mortals had followed them, a narrow column that snaked inside like a parasitic worm infesting a host.
"Cybus isn't going to like this," said Wayland.
"His likes and dislikes are immaterial to me," said Sharukin.
"Easy for you to say," replied Wayland. "Eventually you'll go back to your legion."
Sharukin said nothing in reply and picked captured images of the dreadful fortification in the centre of the plaza, knowing that to assault it would cost thousands of lives. built with incredible economy of time and effort. Its towers were guns taken from the rhinos and armoured vehicles that formed its walls, and wire-surrounded emplacements housed growling land raiders that acted as mobile strong points.
"Is that a shadow sword?" said Wayland.
On a raised platform in the centre of the fortification was a super-heavy tank, but one up-armoured and bulked out to an incredible degree.
"Perturabo's command tank," answered Shadowkin. "Its weapon systems can cover every inch of the walls, and its main gun will simply obliterate anything that comes within its line of fire."
"Then we stay out of its line of fire," said Shadowkin. Two Reaver battle engines bearing the banners and colours of the Legio Mortis faced off against their glassy counterparts, guns trained on them with unwavering precision. Perturabo's warriors were nothing if not thorough.
"A direct assault on this position will be suicidal," declared Wayland.
"That's never been the way of the 19th, said Shadowkin.
"I've come to learn that," said Wayland.
"Come on, Captain Tyro needs to know there's no chance of getting in this way." Shadowkin nodded and moved away from the edge of the roof. This far away from the enemy, there was no need to wraith slip, but he did it anyway. Ever since they'd made planetfall, Shadowkin's preternatural senses had felt hostile eyes upon him, unseen observers watching his every move like a snake preparing to strike. Even moving with all the skill he could muster, he knew they could see him. With sure steps, dizzying powered leaps, and precipitous drops, Shadowkin and Wayland made their way to the sheltered portion of the ground where the incursion force of Iron Hands waited. Shadowkin dropped into shadow, stepping into full view of Cadmus Tyro and Vermana Cybus. Ignatius Newman and Septus Thoic held the quivering form of Veruce Vora between them, and Brother Bombastus towered over them all, the monstrous flamer flickering with a hot jet of blue light.
"Well," asked Cadmus Tyro, "can we fight our way in?"
The captain's face was unreadable behind the iron mask of his helm. His warplate was scored with hundreds of names, so many that there was as much revealed ceramite as there was black paint. He had been in the thick of the hardest fighting on Istvan, and it was easy to forget he had suffered as much as the rest of them. The golden-winged form of Garuda perched on his shoulder guard, wings folded back and its red eyes reminding Shadowkin of Atesh Tarsa. The eagle had a sleek look to it that Shadowkin liked, a hunter on the wing, like him.
"Not a chance," said Shadowkin. "The Iron Warriors already have a fortress built right in front of the entrance. Nothing short of a full legion assault would be able to punch through to the entrance."
"Then we've come this way for nothing," snapped Cybus, slamming a fist into his palm. "I said this was a doomed enterprise from the beginning. We've wasted our time coming here."
"You don't agree," said Tyro, reading Shadowkin's body language.
"Fighting the Iron Warriors head-on will see us all dead," said Shadowkin. "On that, Cybus and I agree, but we don't need to fight them head-on."
"What do you mean?" demanded Tyro.
Shadowkin beckoned Newman and Thoic forwards, and they hauled the sickly-looking Eldar guide to stand before him.
"Because the front door isn't the only way in, is it?"
Veruce Vora looked up and nodded. The flesh of his face stretched tight like grease paper over his jutting bones, his skin veined with purple lines and textured with an oily veneer.
"No," said the Eldar. "There are other ways to enter."